In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress, and today we're speaking with editor Tom Brevoort. Now we're going to go into detail on some of Tom's books, including The Avengers Line, Captain America Reborn, and the new miniseries Strange, written by Mark Waid. But Tom's been working at Marvel for a long time, since the late 80s, and I wanted to take advantage of his perspective and discuss some big picture ideas, the evolution of story events at Marvel Comics, the way new media has affected the relationship between publisher and consumer, and a lot of the ways Marvel Comics has changed in the last 10 years. That's all coming up, but first, let's take a look at Strange, the new miniseries from Mark Waid, in this discussion with Tom Brevoort on Word Balloon. So, am I correct that you are editing both Strange and Dr. Voodoo?
I'm editing Strange. My associate editor, Lauren Sankovich, is editing Dr. Voodoo.
Okay.
But she's just across the way here, so it's very easy to coordinate.
Well, I want to talk about those books, and Strange in particular. I had the opportunity to talk to Rick about Dr. Voodoo, but I know that Strange is debuting this week, and Mark Waid is writing it.
That is true.
And
It seems like you know everything already. What more is there for me to say?
Well, we could talk about this different position for Stephen Strange in this stage in his career, and both as a hero and just in his life.
Well, sure. At this point, the point of Strange, as people saw in the new Avengers storyline that we did last year, Doc is no longer Sorcerer Supreme. He's no longer Doctor Strange. That having access to the power of Zom to fight the Hulk during World War Hulk and getting his hands mangled up again and then using some bad mojo to try and keep it all bottled up and keep it fixed, he sort of had a little fall from grace, and the mantle of Sorcerer Supreme has passed over to Jericho Drum, formerly Brother Voodoo. So at this point, Doc is Doc no more. He is just Strange. There's kind of good and bad that comes with this. And the good is, for the first time in forever, this is a guy who has spent the last bunch of years holding up, carrying the weight of the world on his back, standing, stalwart as a bastion on the wall between everybody and supernatural badness, and now he doesn't have to do that anymore. Somebody else has that job. So on a certain level, there's a liberation about it, that pressure is gone. On the other hand, there's also sort of this underlying tension that way back when he started down the road to becoming a sorcerer, he was an arrogant surgeon, and he loused up, and he, screwed up his hands and lost his gift for surgery, and went off, looking for a cure, and instead found this whole new world of sorcery and this new sort of deeper understanding of the universe. And in a very real way, it feels like, having now come full circle, that he hasn't really learned much of anything at all. He's on kind of a sabbatical and kind of a journey of self-discovery, moving around, using what talents he still possesses, and certainly his knowledge of the mystic arts and of all these supernatural hoodoo that's out there, but really I think sort of trying to figure out what's next, at least on some days enjoying the fact that he doesn't have to worry about the nightmares and Dormammu's and Zoms of the world.
Well, and it seems too that, as you say, it's a self-discovery kind of journey, and I think that's great, because maybe this is one of the reasons why we haven't seen a regular monthly of Doctor Strange in a while. It's tough when you're at the top to keep finding interesting things for the guy to do, and now he's on a different journey to rediscover himself in his place.
He's definitely, the Strange that you'll see in our series, I think you will find, he's definitely more down to earth, he's definitely more relatable, and he's definitely more fun to be around. I think that Doc, while Doc is a great character, and people have said this, on and off for years now, he's one of those characters that was great as a supporting player, that he would show up in your story, provide, your heroes with a bunch of information and a bunch of answers, and usually he'd do some hand-waving and help out at a key place. But, he was also sort of, stoic and all-knowing and a little pompous and a little hard to really create a certain empathy about. Our Stephen Strange, when we pick him up, has really kind of put a lot behind him. We don't actually come out and say it, but we intimate that in between, when he sort of walked off stage at the end of New Avengers and his little appearance in Dr. Voodoo, you know, he went off and into some dimension where he sort of, you know, meditated and got his head on straight, probably far longer than it was, you know, for him than it was for us. He comes back and he seems very much refreshed and very much at ease in his own skin and doing things and going to places that we haven't really seen Doctor Strange go to before. That every Doctor Strange story, you know, forever it seems, has been either, you know, in his cut off sanctum in the middle of Greenwich Village or on some ethereal plane where stalagmites grow and floating eyeballs are around. And so all through the course of our series, you know, Doc is traveling the country. He's in the Midwest. He's in the heartland. He's dealing with situations and things that are going on sort of in the real world and around the activities of real people. And he's having to be a little trickier, a little smarter, use a little more guile, a little more stage misdirection, because he doesn't have the kind of zap it mojo that he once had. And to me, at least, that makes it more interesting as well. That depending on which story you read, which comic you happen to be in, it always seemed like, or it often seemed like, Doc could do anything at any point. And that made it very difficult for there to be stakes. And pretty much from the get-go, the place Doc is calibrated in our series is he can do a few things, but nowhere near as much as he used to be able to do. And really, the best thing he's got going for him is his reputation of having been Doctor Strange, Sorcerer Supreme.
He could bluff his way out of a problem.
Exactly.
That's great. And I think that that puts him on a different journey, and it also obviously, Dr. Voodoo now is living that same early Doctor Strange life of, am I worthy of the mantle of Sorcerer Supreme, and learning the craft as he's going. And it's great to see in the Voodoo book that Nightmare is there, and it reminds me as an old-time Marvel reader of when I first saw Electro in Daredevil.
Sure.
And it's, you know, always exciting when you see an established villain for one character cross into a new book, and yeah, I think it makes the stakes for both, and you've got two interesting magical characters rather than just the one.
Well, that was sort of the point of the whole exercise.
Sure. Oh, definitely.
You know, and hopefully, you know, people find in Dr. Voodoo, you know, a different character with a different set of problems and a different outlook on dealing with the kinds of situations that used to be Doctor Strange situations, as well as, you know, all the mythology and all the wrinkles that come from his own background as the Hungan Supreme and the, you know, the voodoo gods and the legacy of all that, and all that stuff kind of gets to feed in and bounce off of or play in counterpoint to all the sort of traditional typical Marvel sorceress elements like Nightmare and Dormammu and, you know, Mindless Ones and so forth.
Taking a B character and putting him back, you know, in his own book. You mentioned this earlier, that a lot of people felt that maybe Doctor Strange would work best as a supporting character rather than, you know, having his own book. There's several books like that are out now, Doctor Voodoo and Strange being two of them.
Mm-hmm.
Even Secret Warriors, I think, taking Nick Fury onto a new,
right,
set of rules and a new playing field. What do you think of that whole philosophy of, you know, well, some guys just work better in B books?
I think with any character, you know, there are two things. There's track record. Yeah, anybody, you can point to a track record and go, well, you know, Doctor Strange has never really sold a book. And that's an oversimplification. Doc has sold a book for a period of time, but
mm-hmm.
he hasn't been able to consistently hold a series over even 10 years. You know, and the same sort of thing is true of Nick Fury, and the same thing is true of, you know, there are a bunch of Marvel characters that are like that, Ghost Rider maybe.
Sure.
You know, but that doesn't mean these are bad characters, and they certainly doesn't mean that these can't be the characters of the moment. You know, Ghost Rider was an enormous hit in the early 90s. You know, a character who only a few years earlier was kind of written off as, it's kind of a joke, it's a one-note thing, it came out of the 70s, it's goofy, it's kitschy. And the guys that put Ghost Rider together in the 90s found a way to tap into something that was essential about that character and you know, make him really appealing to a whole new generation of readers. And, you know, again, that series came to an end, and there's since been a couple of other Ghost Rider series since. I don't think that there's any character that can't necessarily, you know, strike sparks if you've got the right point of view and the right creators. But the difference is there's stuff that will spark and be sort of, you know, critically acclaimed or beloved. The tricky is getting a wide enough audience to beloved it that you can make it an ongoing concern.
I understand.
And that's always the push and pull that we have to struggle with any of these characters. Particularly characters that have this sort of long history, like guys like Fury and Doctor Strange and, you know, any of the real mainstays of the Marvel Universe. You know, people love them and people are invested in them. Our creators are invested in them. The readers are invested in them to one degree or another. You know, and eventually, if you happen to do the right thing and put them in the right place and set them up, you can have a Spider-Woman series. You can have a Ms. Marvel series. You can have these things and have them have some legs and go on for a significant amount of time, if not indefinitely, by just, you know, having the right creators who have the right take and just finding that place to kind of realign them in the Marvel Universe and dig down to what it was that was unique and interesting about them in the first place and, you know, find some new way to make that relevant today.
Now, as someone who has, you know, been in the editorial chair and been part of Marvel for as long as you have, I'm curious about these last 10 years, mm-hmm. because so much has changed, and also it being kind of an anniversary year, the 70th anniversary, but also those 10 years, I think, since Joe and Bill Gemmis first, you know, took over in the late 90s to where we are now with Joe running things as editor-in-chief.
Sure.
Is there something about this new generation of writers that you think is different from ones that have come before? As you say, guys like Howard Mackey had the right idea with Ghost Rider in the
right.
90s, and I'm
going to say it's probably not the popular answer.
I'm curious, though.
But
yeah.
It may be the right answer. I don't think it's anything so specific, although I think that the overall level of quality, the overall level of craft in terms of the writing and the emphasis on the writing over the last 10 years has gone up, has gotten higher. The bar is set much higher now. And the caliber of writers who've entered into the comics field, whether it's, you know, sort of as tourists doing a little project here and there because they're busy working on million-dollar motion pictures, or people that just love it and will do extended runs or, and, you know, really kind of make their home at a Marvel or a place like this. So I think that the bar has definitely been raised in terms of the caliber and the quality of most of the writers that we're using. I don't think the underlying philosophy has changed all that much. Again, you'd go back to the 90s or the 80s or whatnot, when you'd go back and you'd dust off and you'd try and find a way to find a new wrinkle in a character and a new take on an established classic that maybe had fallen off the path a little bit. It was very much the same sort of process. It's just today, because the bar has been raised and because we've cast our net wider and because comics as a medium have gained greater acceptance and been embraced by certainly Hollywood and big media. You know, we're covered now. We're watched. We're seen as a vital part of pop culture. People are more likely, talented people are more likely to want to come and do some of what we do and play with some of these characters that they might have thought were, you know, forever cut off to them. And so that just means everybody has to work a little harder. But it also means that the overall bar is set a little higher. So I don't know. I don't know if I answered that question or not.
No, I think you did, actually.
You know, what's different about this generation of writers is, you know, they're gooder.
Well, and I see a lot deeper characterization and questioning and answering the motivations of character more in the last 10 years, I would say, than previous years. That I think we're just riding on the established thought of, well, you know, we're just, you know, giving you the best ideas of what, you know, Stan, Jack, and company put out there first, and we're just kind of putting our spin on it. It was plot-driven more, I think, mm-hmm. in those previous decades, and now it is more a re-examination of who is this character in the first place.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, like everything, forms evolve. You know, comics evolve, storytelling styles evolve. You know, I was around for when, you know, those big heady days of the mid 80s, 85 and 86, when Alan Moore was doing stuff and Frank Miller was doing stuff, and suddenly every comic in the world had first person gritty narration, because Frank had done it in Daredevil and he'd done it in Dark Knight, and suddenly, you know, people immediately clicked to this. Oh, you know, the thought balloons are passe. This is better.
The dialogue box, yeah.
And you know, so you get these kind of seismic changes. And, you know, like anything, it's a tool in the toolbox. There are some people that do it extremely well. There are some people that do it adequately. There are some people that do it clumsily. You know, so too, I think as you know, we've moved ahead, you know, the kinds of themes that get explored, the kinds of stories that are being told, and you know, the greater depth and nuance of characterization and importance of that, you know, the greater sophistication is just sort of, you know, the inevitable growth of all the stuff that had been set before. You know, there are guys that come along and sort of change the game just by their outlook on things. You know, certainly Brian Bendis is a writer who's had a fairly significant impact on how, not just Marvel comics, how comics, mainstream comics are done. You know, what makes for an exciting issue, what makes for an interesting situation. And, you know, Brian is very influenced by film. He's almost more, you know, a film guy who does comics than a comic guy in a certain way, at least in terms of his sense of language and his sense of scene structure and so forth. And, you know, when he started out doing that, his sort of books in the early 2000s for Marvel on Daredevil and Ultimate Spider-Man and so forth, you know, they were kind of shocking because they didn't follow the established, you know, pattern and the established thinking of the time. But that made them, you know, fresh and interesting and novel, and the way he would drill down and get into these characters, into these personalities, and really root around on them and apply, you know, sort of, you know, high-level screenwriting philosophy to what characters were doing, where, you know, it's something as simple as the character would be saying something and would be thinking the opposite, and he would, you know, Brian would find a way to convey that on the page, along with Mark Bagley and along with Alex Maleev and along with whomever else.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, he approached it with that sort of a mentality. And, you know, to the point where, you know, now 10 years later, you know, not to say that that's passé, that's just, you know, part and parcel of what people do. And you can look around and you can find half a dozen other guys whose comic book work is fairly directly influenced by what Brian had done and who, you know, have adopted some of those philosophies and some of those thought processes to what they're doing. So again, I think it's all kind of the organic growth of comics. Somebody hits on something. Somebody finds another way to do things. You know, there are guys that are, you know, have sort of picked up the baton that you know, somebody like Warren Ellis lays down in terms of, here's how I think about things. Here's the kinds of stories that I do. Here's how I approach them. You know, here's how I build a scene. Here's how I build a sequence. Here's how I pace a comic book. And other people who really respond to that and enjoy that, you know, up-and-coming writers, you know, sort of absorb it and adopt it into their own philosophy and then move it forward by combining it with their own other influences and whatever other creativity they have within themselves. And so, you know, you're kind of always sort of pushing the ball forward. And then, you know, in a larger sense, Brian reads the Warren Ellis comics and goes, wow, I really love the way he you know, sets this up and paces this out and gives you this big bang here, and I want to try and do some of that. And Warren reads a Bendis comic and goes, I like the way he was able to pace this in what seems to be more leisurely in terms of it's a conversation that goes on for 8 pages, but the conversation has enough crackle and enough up and down and build that it works as a tense scene. I want to do more of that. And so this all kind of feeds back in and among itself, among all the better guys, so that, you know, hopefully you're kind of distilling the best aspects and attributes and elements of everybody. Again, I don't know if I answered any of these questions, but
no,
it at least sounded sensible.
Well, I want your point of view. This is good, and I want to know what you think of all these things, because you're really in the seat. You're at the intersection, mm-hmm, of a lot of these different writers, both when you're just in your editorial role and also sitting in the retreats that you guys have been having.
Sure.
How much does that come through in the retreats where you really see? I mean, I know that, and in reading some recent articles of yours in the last few months, you've talked about how a lot of the beats of Civil War and Avengers Disassembled came from retreats, and, mm-hmm, you know, maybe Mark Miller, you know, saying something that was driving him nuts at the time about the Avengers, him and Brian going to dinner and coming back the next day at the retreat with a whole idea that became Avengers Disassembled, or at least some of the beats of that.
Yep.
How much of that happens really in the retreat, and how much do you see, you know, it organically happening like that?
It's both, and it's difficult to distill it down to an actual percentage.
Well, yeah, I understand.
You know, in again, in the broadest terms, you know, what you get in the retreat is the broadest strokes, you know, the broadest beats. The writers who actually are writing these books, if it's Brian on Avengers, or if it's Mark on Civil War, or if it's Jeff Loeb on Hulk, or mm-hmm. if it's Warren on Ultimate Iron Man, you know, whoever happens to be in that room, they're writing their own books. But in terms of sitting down and discussing these stories and dissecting them and throwing ideas around and coming up with new ideas and coming up with better ideas, you know, a lot of broad strokes and a lot of broad beats, you know, do kind of get hammered out. Again, particularly when you're talking about larger events like Civil War that impact on so many books and impact on the Marvel Universe as a whole. There's a lot more back and forth than there would be if you were just writing a Spider-Man story where Spider-Man fights Doc Ock. I mean,
right.
Certainly everybody in that room might have an opinion about it and say, well, you should give Doc Ock six arms or he should have contact lenses now because glasses are passé, or he really needs to grow a mustache. You know, everybody might have their own particular thing and argue vociferously for why that's good, or argue vociferously why the opposite is bad or doesn't make sense or could be better. I don't understand this whole mustache thing. But at the end of the day, the writer who comes in and has to go off and write that Spider-Man comic goes off and does so. Him and, you know, his editor is as kind of his wingman. But having taken on board or had the ability to take on board all of this feedback and all of this workshopping back and forth between all of these people.
Is it fair to say that, and I don't want you to get into, and I know you won't, get into story specifics that's coming up as we transition from Dark Reign to the Siege to the Historic Age. It is those broad strokes that are being discussed then at the retreats?
Yeah, the Heroic Age rather than the Historic Age.
Thank you. Okay, yes.
It's not yet the Historic Age. Ten years from now, when we're looking back on it, it will be the Historic Age. But
for now,
it is the Heroic Age.
Well,
specifically, you know, as we you know, moved ahead, you know, the last one of these big retreats we had a bunch of our guys come up and more or less, you know, talk through what they were planning to do in each of their titles. So, you know, Matt Fraction said, here's what I'm planning for Iron Man. And Jonathan Hickman laid out 3 million issues of Fantastic Four with charts and things. And, you know, Jeff Loeb went through all of his Hulk plans. And Ed Brubaker talked about all the Captain America stuff. And, again, at every stage, you know, people vetted back and forth ideas and bounced things around and went, hey, that could work great with what I'm doing over here, or I don't get that. Why are you doing this? I don't understand this. And sometimes you'll bog down in stuff where it's just a difference of opinion, you know, where somebody would just do something differently. If I were writing that, I would choose red instead of blue. But you know, even those discussions can be helpful, if only to crystallize why you think blue is better in your own mind. And particularly once you leave the room, you've still got the option to write blue, or you can write red, or you can write orange, or you can write purple, depending on what this is all, how this is all, you know, shaken out in your own mind. Assuming that whatever color you've chosen works and makes sense and holds water. But yeah, all of that stuff was being discussed moving ahead.
Is the idea behind the Heroic Age then to, it seems like Dark Reign, and I know you guys have said this in interviews as well and characterize it more as a status quo change versus than a real event.
Yep.
And is Heroic Age in that same light as a status quo change? Or?
Yeah, it is very much like, I think we've sort of now got a methodology, and I don't want to make it sound like it's a formula because it's not quite a formula, but, you know, since doing House of M, we have a methodology about how our big event storylines function. You know, we do these big event storylines, and it's House of M, and there's a story in House of M, and it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and stuff happens along the way that causes consequences and ripples that spread out throughout the rest of the Marvel Universe and become sort of the lay of the land for the Marvel U. In the case of House of M, that's there's no more mutants, and what does this mean, and what does this do to all the X-Men books, and Wolverine remembers everything about his past, and what does that do to him, and, you know, all of these things, you know, that come out into, well, I guess we were labeling it decimation at that point.
Yes.
And the same sort of thing with Civil War. By the end of Civil War was a story. It had a beginning, middle, and end. It was about this thing, and at the end of it, the landscape of the world had changed. And coming out of Civil War into the Initiative thereafter, it was the same kind of thing. The Initiative, you know, bannering and so forth was more about this is the lay of the land in the Marvel Universe now in a pro-registration Tony Stark world. And then after Secret Invasion, going into Dark Reign, same sort of thing. Secret Invasion was a story about this particular thing, this Skrull clandestine invasion. But coming out of it, the landscape of the Marvel Universe has changed again, and the villains are on top, and Norman Osborn is kind of running everything, and the heroes are on the ropes a little more. So, too, after Siege, the Heroic Age is really about, here's the landscape of the Marvel Universe now, and here's how it's changed again, and here's how it's not just simply gone back to, well, everything's back in its nice, neat, orderly box, just where you'd expect it, and just the way you grew up with, and you can close the book now and go about your business. Things will wind up in, again, hopefully a place and a position that's interesting to readers and want to make them come back next month and want to see how each of these individual characters fits in among this sort of new status quo of the Marvel Universe for the foreseeable future until we shake it up again at some point down the line.
When I talked to Brian in Baltimore, we were talking about Siege, and I noticed that the major beats of Siege is, am I correct, 4 issues?
Yes, 4 issues.
Okay. I was wondering if the economic change from, $2.99 to $3.99 might be playing a role in shorter story arcs, because that was something I think you guys have found a good balance of leaving the audience wanting more, mm-hmm. and certainly in the case of Dark Reign, I think you've been able to tell a lot of interesting stories within this new status quo, but also know to get off stage with this premise before it gets old.
Right.
And I appreciate
you saying that.
Well, I believe it. And also, another example of that, too, is I think Bucky as Captain America, and I know you're presiding over
right.
or editing Captain America
yep,
as
yep.
Ed is doling it out. And, yeah, I mean, and it's funny to see now, too, that DeFalco has come back with how he would have ended the Spider clone.
Yep.
Story, and you can't help but make the comparisons of events that went on too long, mm-hmm. more than 10 years ago, to the way you guys handle them now. And
right.
I'm wondering how much economics is now also playing a role in that. Because my point being that I think sometimes I'd almost like to see a few more meaningful stories squeezed out during
right.
during a certain status quo.
Well, I don't know that economics has anything to do, incredibly overtly. It's
okay.
something that I think each individual creator and certainly each individual editor is aware of. And the fact that we're charging umpty ump dollars for each issue and that's a lot to ask of a readership base that's being just as squeezed financially as every one of us. And so there's a greater and greater pressure to make sure that what we're providing, what we're doing, the stories we're telling, and the artwork we're presenting and generating, is worth the expense, worth the consumer, and make them feel pleased enough and excited enough and interested enough that they want to come back again. I think Siege being 4 issues had more to do with Brian, learning things from having done Secret Invasion and having done House of M. In terms of how to manage a crossover and manage that number of characters and the flow of plot lines and things. And also him looking around and seeing how other people were doing things and kind of challenging himself to switch things up. Having worked on all 3 of them, I see a fairly clear progression from House of M to Secret Invasion. That there were some very specific lessons that Brian sort of took away from having done House of M, where, after the fact, at retreats or just in conversations or whatnot, we would talk about how that all came together and how, what we might have done differently or might have been able to tighten things up here and there or might have let some more thread out in another area to give another moment room to breathe. So I think in terms of Siege being that compact, it's not really, motivated solely by economics, but by the kind of story that it is and the lessons that we've picked up from the past. But I'd be lying if I said there wasn't some amount of an economic rationale for that, because this is the world around us. This is
sure.
what we're reacting to 24/7.
Are you in charge? Are you in charge of the list books?
I oversaw the I didn't edit every single one. The individual editors of the titles involved did.
Sure. Okay.
But I sort of took point and oversaw them in that I'm the Avengers guy and, by extension, the Dark Reign guy and on the Siege guy. So I oversaw the whole of the line, but each individual book within that, Wolverine the list was edited by Axel and the Punisher was edited by Axel and the Spider-Man's being edited by Steve Wacker and
sure. okay.
Hulk was edited by Mark Panisha. I directly edited the Avengers one and the Secret Warriors one, but then I kept an eye on all 8 of them.
Okay. Well, I was going to say I thought. that those were interesting on the other side of the coin, because I think as one-shots, those were some of the more effective one-shots that I think I've seen in a long time.
Well, thank you.
Where, yeah. Well, you know, honestly, and I would say the same thing to Wachter about the Spider-Man 600, and certainly Axel, specifically on his books that he oversaw as far as the list books go, because they were. I think that's been an interesting problem as well from an economic standpoint. And it's funny now, because I think for years, comic fans wanted a one-shot that meant something.
Yeah.
And that really felt like a satisfying story.
Yep.
And I think it's, again, there's been a progression to telling a modern story in 22 pages and having it be effective. I think some of the what-ifs, frankly, from a couple of years ago were just not as strong as those what-if, you know, individual issues were, certainly during the original run when maybe it was 32 pages of story.
Yep, yep.
But, yeah, you know, I mean, it just seemed like...
Well, what if in particular is a tough nut to crack in 22 pages? Because quite often you're dealing with situations that played themselves out over, even if it was six issues of a monthly comic. And in a lot of cases, it's more like, you know, 12, a year's worth of stuff, and usually with a million characters. You almost forced to shorthand your storytelling in What If, because there's just so much to get in. Yeah, that's one of the reasons why back in the 70s, them doing, you know, What If as a double-sized book was really advantageous. It gave them a lot more pages to play on. And you know, build decent characterization and build some decent character conflicts, and not just kind of have to, you know, gloss over and bare bones a lot of stuff because you just don't have the space for it. You know, the interesting thing about what you're saying, though, too, to me is, you know, I see feedback and I read stuff from all sorts of people. You know, people that send emails in and people that post reviews and are on message boards.
Sure.
and you know, chats and so forth, and. You know, the commonality among them all is that there is no real commonality. that you know, every one of them individually wants the thing that they want, and within a great number of them, you can sort of get a larger consensus for here's the state of the marketplace. But you know, particularly when it comes to crossovers, there are two or three very distinctive camps, and they're all vocal. And they're all really hardline. And I've heard from every single one of them doing Secret Invasion and doing Civil War and doing House of M, and I'm, you know, ready to hear from them again during Siege, because and none of them are wrong. It's just, you know, what they want from their comic book reading experience.
Sure.
There is the core group that wants to be able to read the main book. I want to read Siege, or I want to read Secret Invasion. Let's do Secret Invasion, because at least it was that's done, and I don't need to dance around plot points or anything.
Yeah.
You know, I want to read Secret Invasion, and I want to read those eight issues and feel like I got the entire story. And here you are doing issues of Avengers or issues of Spider-Man or issues of whatever that I feel are important. Why wasn't that in Secret Invasion? And, you know, on the other hand, you've got people who, you know, I'm buying every tie-in book, or I'm buying a lot of them because I naturally read Avengers and I naturally read Spider-Man, I naturally read Thor or whatever. And, you know, suddenly you've got all this stuff spilling over from this other book that I don't care as much about. and you know, why isn't it in the main book? And why is this, you know, like you know, depending on who you are, what your buying habits are, you know, what your particular, you know, position is, you know, I have fans who are railing, oh, my God, is Siege going to boil over into Captain America because has been able to do such a great job on Captain America and not get tangled up in all this other stuff.
Right, don't stop the story, sure.
And then, you know, there's the other people that are like, when is Captain America going to get involved in Siege and all this stuff? It seems like every time you do a big story, you know, there's never any consequence in Captain America. All the Captain America stuff is in the main book, and, you know, why?
Hilarious.
So it's, you know, it's always a balancing act, you know, figuring out with the creators, what's the best and smartest way, you know, what stories we have to tell and what opportunities there are to tell these stories and where to tell them most effectively, you know, backwards and forwards. And you know, quite frankly, a lot of this is economically based on the part of the fans. Everybody that's buying stuff, one, doesn't want to feel like, I got to buy more stuff. You know, I feel I want to be able to get what I want out of whatever I'm buying, and I want every purchase to feel like it mattered. I got something of consequence out of it. And unfortunately, or fortunately, there is no one right answer. You know, we could pick any particular path, and we try very hard. We may not always succeed. We try very, very hard to balance those scales. You know, I spend hours trying to make sure that if you're reading the main book, if you just read Secret Invasion front to back, and you just read Civil War front to back, and you just read House of M, which was a little easier, front to back, you've got a story. And you've got a beginning, middle, and end, and everything that you need is there. Not necessarily everything you want. If you happen to be interested in, you know, what the Fantastic Four are like in the world of House of M, or what's going on with you know, Spidey, the most popular hero in the world, but everything you need for that story. By the same token, we try very, very hard that, you know, if you're buying Spider-Man House of M or Fantastic Four House of M or you know, any of these tie-ins, that you're getting a story that's there that matters, that says something about the characters, that, again, is complete enough that you don't really feel like you absolutely have to have read every issue of the main book, although in those cases it probably is going to help a little more than ordinarily, and that you're getting a lasting experience out of it. And you know, that's the dichotomy. People who are just reading the main book would rather all the goodness be in the main book, and people that want to read House of M Spider-Man want to be sure that there's a certain amount of goodness in that. So that's, you know, I mean, that's just the back and forth of it all.
I can appreciate that, and it was the one negative critique I had, and a small one, to Brian about Secret Invasion. I thought the epilogues that were in Mighty Avengers and New Avengers were still part of the big story, and I had hoped that when it was collected, that those last two issues, because I thought the emotional end of Secret Invasion was carried in those two issues more so than in the main book.
Right.
And that you needed those kind of moments of, you know, Hank at Jan's funeral, really, you know, breaking down and telling Tony, you know, fuck you. And also Bucky in New Avengers saying, I know you people feel like you have nowhere to go. You're Steve's team. Mm-hmm. You're my team. You know, you can be here. And it really had that kind of, you know, emotional ending, I guess, that I didn't see in Secret Invasion. But again, personal taste. Like I told Brian, he didn't shoot my dog.
And you know, again, on the flip side of that, you know, you've got there, you know, three stories that you liked. They may not have been lined up exactly the way you would have wanted them, or in exactly the books where you would have, you know, liked them. But you know, you remember them much more facilely than I did. I was sitting here, casting my mind back, trying to remember what exactly was in the last Secret Invasion issue. You know, I remember it all, but I didn't remember having to recall that specific. And I remember them both. One was New Avengers 48, the cap scene, and the other was Mighty 20. It's just sitting here, and you say, oh, the last issues of Secret Invasion and the Avengers books, I had to cast my mind back. What were those?
Oh, I can only imagine.
No, it wasn't the Elektra issue. No, it wasn't the Hank issue. No, it wasn't the... which one was it? You know, but again, those are affecting moments and affecting scenes, and you could have trade paperback them. You could have collected them with those things. On the other hand, you know, in both cases, they seem part and parcel of other stories.
I understand that too.
You know, in the case of the Cap thing, that was actually the beginning of that next, you know, Dark Reign story in New Avengers. And so, while that scene might have worked nicely with Secret Invasion, that whole issue and everything that was going on there with Norman and with the guys really had to be part of the 48, 49, 50. You know, collection of stories. And it's the same kind of thing with the Mighty Avengers issue, that it was really the capstone to all of the Secret Invasion tie-ins during Mighty Avengers, and so it kind of sat better with that. But again, you know, either way, you like them both, and, you know, you're certainly you're more than welcome to have a difference of opinion about, you know, how they lay out and so forth. You know, the fact that you enjoyed them all, that to me is the most important thing.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think maybe because I'm an older reader, I'm the kind of older reader that have seen, you know, the woman rescued from the train tracks enough times that I really do welcome these new writers with their different ideas and also different solutions from an action standpoint. I think Dan Slott right now on Mighty Avengers, for having such a classic, what seems to be on the surface a classic team, and also interestingly a team of a lot of B-level Avengers, you know, but is able to come up with inventive action solutions to a lot of these problems. And just the Hank Pym show has just been a blast. It really has, man.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. That book too has been a very divisive book.
Sure.
And again, I think a lot of it had to do as much with, you know, reader expectation or reader desire than it was the actuality of that book. I think that certainly when it was first announced that Dan was going to be taking over Mighty, and he started talking about the kind of book he wanted to do, you know, I think a lot of particularly older time Avengers fans jumped up and down, and they were really hoping for a very specific sort of thing and a very specific sort of flavor. And I think they've been a little bit flummoxed by the fact that it's not exactly that. And at the same time, the more modern audience, maybe, who are steeped absolutely in the work Brian has done on the Avengers books over the last 6 years, have been a little bit flummoxed by the fact that it's not so lockstep in terms of tone and style with what Brian does.
Sure.
But by the same token, you know, to me, that's the you know, kind of the whole point. You know, having somebody else doing Brian Light on another Avengers title, it seems counterintuitive to me.
Absolutely.
You know, Brian writing as many Avengers books as he can is great, that he has stories to tell and can go out and be Brian Bendis. But if I'm going to have somebody who's not Brian, you know, trying to do their best, you know, a Brian face impression, is not going to be as likely to be successful or be effective as, you know, somebody doing taking it and putting their own spin on it. Or it could, you know, it could just be that you know, we didn't entirely hit the ball right every time out of the gate. That happens too.
Now, as Chris takes over Mighty, what can you tell us about the difference, you know, shifting completely to him? I know he's been co-writing with Dan the last couple
Chris
of
years. Chris is not taking over Mighty.
Oh, excuse me.
I can tell you that.
Oh, okay. Oh, then maybe he was just helping Dan out.
Yeah, Chris was helping Dan out, helped us out for a couple of months, and then Dan is coming back full time. Chris is writing Avengers the Initiative,
right?
You know, completely solo, and has been since issue 25.
Oh, yeah.
And he's also involved in some other books and things that we have coming up out of Siege and Into Heroic Age that I can't actually tell you about just yet.
No, I understand that.
So we like Gage just fine, and appreciate him. Appreciate him big time helping out on Mighty as you know, Dan started to get jammed up with things and with Spidey and with another thing that he was working on that again I can't quite talk about yet.
It's cool.
you know, so you know, but they're you know, Chris came on to Initiative initially to co-write with Dan and then,
right.
You know, ended up taking over the book there. So him stepping in to help out on Mighty was, you know, very much an extension of a relationship that already kind of existed.
Avengers seems to be taking that, you know, X-Men on the surface path of all these different Avenger-style books. But as you say, they each have different characteristics, and it isn't all just, in this case, Bendis light, and that you're following the same game plan for all of them. Chris is very different from Brian,
yep.
And obviously Dan is very different from Brian and Chris as well.
Right.
And yeah, it was, you know, it's maybe, and I'm one of those guys that isn't steeped in X-Men mythology, and I read Uncanny because I like Matt's writing.
Yep.
But I haven't really investigated the other books, and never did because I always felt it was too continuity heavy. Was
mm-hmm.
there ever any concern that as you guys split off into these Avenger books, I know that they're, you know, since Brian has taken over the main books, how popular the titles have become,
right?
And that it's a good thing to be called an Avenger book these days. But yeah, I mean, is there concern of, you know, being too continuity heavy or whatever, you know, differences that would keep it from being penetrated, you know what I mean?
Yeah, we worry about this kind of thing all the time. You know, particularly Brian, who you know, more than anybody is very concerned about, you know, overstretching, you know, the Avengers name and what that means, and just, you know, using it as a cheap cover to sell a bunch of unrelated comics. You know, to me, it's, you know, it all goes back to the same sort of central thinking that I use about any series that I launch, Avengers or otherwise, you know, which basically boils down to what does this book do in the Marvel publishing line that no other book does? What ground does it stand on that is uniquely its own? You know, if it's just another Avengers book, you know, is there enough of a reason for it to be there? And if the answer is no, or the answer seems like it's no, or enough people say no, then we don't do it. You know, we certainly have expanded the number of Avengers titles over the last couple of years from one to, I guess we're up to about four now. You know, and we've done so sort of slowly and deliberately, almost in every case, coinciding with you know, a seismic shift in the Marvel Universe.
Yes.
You know, that when we launched Mighty, it was on the heels of Civil War.
Right.
And at that point, you know, whereas I'd resisted that sort of temptation for the longest time, it made a great deal of sense. Because what you essentially ended up with is you ended up with, you know, more or less Tony's team and more or less Cap's team, even though Cap was dead.
Sure.
And that, you know, that made a lot of sense at that point. It also made a lot of sense to do the Initiative because Mark had set up all this structure in Civil War and you know, paying off on it and building on that and bringing in some new characters and bringing back some old favorites. it also seemed like a good use of time. And then when we got to the end of Secret Invasion and planning Dark Reign, it made a lot of sense to do Dark Avengers. And there was enough interest and enough support and enough whatever for Mighty that it made more sense to just continue to move ahead with that and find a way to make that different and make that special and keep it around. But we worry about that all the time.
Sure.
And I certainly don't want to just be generating Avengers book after Avengers book after Avengers book. In the same way that I'm a lunatic pit bull, as some people around here will tell you, with tie-in issues and making sure that we don't have meaningless tie-ins to whatever the crossover of the day may be.
Yes.
You've got to convince me that what you're going to do in this book is worth having my banner on, because I don't want any banners on any books ever.
Well, if I may,
or it seems like to some people, in the same sort of way, I don't want to put out Avengers books that I don't think are worthwhile. There's always the balance of what does the audience want, what does the market want, and right this moment, people seem to like what's going on in the world of the Avengers. So again, it's striking a balance and not just doing a bunch of books because you can, but having something to say, having a point of view, having characters that you can progress forward and put into interesting places and interesting scenarios and having some kind of core concept that's a little different from everything else.
Well, and I think that shows through too on what Jonathan Hickman's been able to do with the Fantastic Four. I think that Dark Reign miniseries was a great story on its own, and then of course set up his first arc.
Yep.
in FF, and great going, man. I mean, I've said this to John as well, but really, and it does make it easier when you've got John, Dale Eaglesham, Paul Mounts all
yep.
together working as well.
Absolutely.
Out.
Well, again, all real kudos go to those guys. The most you can kind of give me is, well, I kind of put them together in that configuration, and they bounce some ideas off me or whatever, but really, it's those guys that go out and craft these stories and come up with these ideas and certainly sit at the drawing board and draw all those beautiful pages and color all those beautiful pages and so forth. So I'm glad pleasantly surprised as to how well the Hickman Eaglesham run. It's only been three issues, but how well it's been received by everybody. It seems to be a lot of people are talking about FF. A lot more people seem to be talking about FF than had been a year ago.
Absolutely. Well, and I can appreciate that. And you've had good people working on the book. I mean, that's the thing. I think every intention has been to make a good FF book in the last few years.
Sure.
And certainly, when you look at the guys like Dwayne McDuffie and Straczynski and the people that have been writing, and certainly Mark's run with mm-hmm. that just wrapped up. I mean, that's the thing. And I really enjoyed Mark's story in particular as well before Jonathan took over. But yeah, Jonathan is another new writer that is bringing a very interesting energy mm-hmm. and big idea, a lot of big ideas to his stories. And can you talk about that? I know he won that Marvel talent. Did he win a Marvel talent, or was it a CBR talent thing? I can't even remember what that
I think
was.
It was a CBR talent thing.
Well, how did you become aware of him?
I became aware of him because, I sort of knew who he was out in the world from Nightly News and
certainly
Pax Romana and so forth, but I hadn't really had any contact with him. I hadn't been following him. I'd never talked to him or whatnot, and there was a point as we were starting to get to the middle point of Secret Invasion where, Brian was going to be writing a number of books that spun out of it. He was going to be doing Dark Avengers and, staying on New Avengers, obviously, and he was going to be doing Spider-Woman, and he was going to be doing Secret Warriors, and we kind of looked at this and went, Brian, you can't, even you can't do this much. Something has got to give. And it was Brian who came back and said, well, how about this? What if I've been liking the stuff that John Hickman's been doing. I don't know him all that well, but, I've been loving what he's doing. What if we co-wrote Secret Warriors? And then, he could do that and get his foot in the Marvel door and kind of establish himself. And in that way, I won't have to do as much heavy lifting, and I'll be able to focus on Spider-Woman and Dark Avengers and so forth. And I thought that sounded like a pretty good plan. And so that's really how I became aware of it all. And, very quickly, just because he took the bull by the horns and kind of ran with the ball, Brian wound up doing less and less on Secret Warriors over the course of those first issues, to the point where by around issue 4 and issue 5, he was saying, Can I take my name off this? I'm really not doing anything here at this point. And I had to say, no, Brian, you're one, you helped, come up with this initial six-issue story, and two, just having your name there is getting a lot more people to pay attention to it than if it was John Hickman, the guy that only you and I have heard of. So yes,
I understand.
We're going to keep your name on to the end of this arc anyway. But it was you know good that Jonathan got his chance to come in and prove his chops and you know begin to show what he could do, and then you know interact with me to the point where as I started to cast around for you know who would take over FF with Mark and Brian going, you know, I gravitated towards him. You know, and I sort of intuited. I don't think it was a really conscious decision at the time. Not that that's so calculated, but you know, over the years I'd gone to very established people to do FF. That there was always a benchmark, always sort of a bar. It was always somebody that was you know JMS and Dwayne and Mark and
yes.
I felt sort of an instinctive desire to go to or towards a younger writer, not necessarily a less experienced writer, but a younger writer who'd have a slightly different perspective and could bring something new and something unique to the series. And you know, I spoke to him about it, and you know, he was never a big FF guy. He was never a huge FF reader, and so he did what Jonathan Hickman does. He went out and read about 5,000 FF comics. I think he got the run on DVD that we put out a couple of years back.
Oh, sure.
He read a million things, and in that way was sort of able to absorb and distill down what he liked about the book and what he liked about the characters and what he thought worked, apart from any strong feeling of nostalgia. You know, there was no real period where, you know, as a young lad, Jonathan Hickman was an avid Fantastic Four reader. He probably read it from time to time. He was certainly aware of it, but it wasn't his big comic. And so, you know, he was able to view with a dispassionate eye everything from Stan and Jack up to the present and figure out what he thought worked for him and what he thought didn't work and you know where to go, you know, what you could do with it moving ahead. And that's pretty much been what he's been doing. And you know, as it turns out, and you talk to him now and you know he'll tell you that in a lot of ways he feels like Fantastic Four right now is the most personal work that he's done for Marvel, that he's really found something or invested something of himself into those characters and those situations, and they speak to him in a way that's a little more personal to him. So this is just, you know, it's good editing. it's just the luck or the right instinct that you know picks the right person for the right job at the right time.
I would agree. Tell me about Ed and Captain America. I mean, that's been a really cool ride, and I know we're coming to a head in December with the one shot, and you know, we will see the Marvel Universe where Steve Rogers and Bucky Barnes, both as Captain America, exist at least for the moment.
Well, you know, the first thing to talk about for 2 seconds, because I've got
Please.
A little audience here, is the fact that Reborn is going to go to 6 issues.
Okay.
this was a complete accident or a complete fumble on our part, or really a misestimation. We you know when we blocked the story out originally we went you know 5 and it seemed to structure out perfectly and everything was good and you know when it came to write issue 5 Ed did a first draft of the issue 5 plot and there just was not enough room that he was having to truncate too many beats and too many moments and things were just not coming off and this was a real crisis for us because right after Reborn 5 comes Who Will Wield the Shield, and after that comes all the stuff going into Siege, and
certainly
we were kind of, you know, we were kind of locked and kind of stuck, and so, you know, we've made the choice after some discussions here and so forth. We've made the decision we're going to go to 6 issues on Reborn, and the 6th one is going to come out after Who Will Wield the Shield, even though it takes place chronologically before, and so I'm just here to ask the patience. of readers everywhere who will no doubt be flabbergasted by this.
Oh yeah, way
and,
to go!
And dumbfounded and irate and so forth. And you know we know this is not an ideal situation. And if I could have moved you know Wield and all the other stuff back to accommodate it, I would have. But this was a case where it just couldn't be done. And rather than have Reborn come to a wet noodle of a conclusion. You know, I made the decision that for the people that have read it all the way through, for people who will eventually read it as a collection, you know, and for people who've been reading Cap going all the way back to when Ed started 5 years ago, I want to make sure that the story is as strong and as rich as it can be, even though it means there are people that are going to come to you know, Who Will Wield and feel like, oh, everything's upside down and backwards now. What is happening? Can't they get their act together? The answer is no, we can't. but you know, we're choosing to make this decision, you know, hoping that the actual stories will be the better for it. Sorry about that, folks. It got away from us, but it got away from us hopefully in a good way.
Will the events of what happened in the one shot then of Who Will Wear the Shield, when it comes time for the trade, is Who Will Wear the Shield its own story and wouldn't be included in Reborn?
Yeah, the Who Will Wield will probably be included with the next actual Cap collection.
I understand.
It won't be in the Reborn collection.
I see.
Fortunately, you know, Wield will tell you maybe some things about how Reborn ends, but not everything. That Ed very cannily wrote it so as not to reveal everything about the end of Reborn, which it turned out was a smart move.
When will the sixth issue be coming out?
I believe the sixth issue will be out in January.
Okay.
So it won't be that much of a wait, but it'll be just enough that you know, as hard as Brian Hitch has been working, and one of the things too that I want to point out here, because while I think people have sort of noticed it subliminally, I don't know that they've been paying attention to it enough to really realize. Hitch on every issue of Reborn has done well in excess of 22 pages of story. Now, the shortest issue of Reborn so far has been 28 pages long.
Wow, I hadn't realized that. That's
great. And the one that we just shipped, issue 4, I believe, is something like 31. So he's been going all out, and he's been working like a demon. He and then Butch Geiss along with him.
Yeah.
To really make this an expansive roller coaster ride, and the real reality of it was, he couldn't, even he could not do, 48 pages or 56 pages or whatnot in the time we had. Again, Reborn 5 will be another, more than 22-page issue. Right now, it'll probably be in the neighborhood of 28, and then Reborn 6 again, another 28, and by the time we wrap it all up, maybe 31 again. These are larger than normal, and consequently, they take a little more time.
Sure.
Like I say, I don't think that anybody really realizes that for the cover price they're paying, they're actually getting a substantive amount of additional material there. And that too is one of the things that kind of came and bit us on the backside in the end, because there are only so many hours in the day and so many days in the week.
Well, I saw your blog and you talked about the price of a $3.99 book and what is put in to increase the value of it and how it is interpreted by the audience sometimes.
Yep.
And I can appreciate that. And I think, the same question goes to readers' minds both negatively and positively. And also, I was reading the comments, and in some of them I kind of agreed, where you said that, when you include an interview and things, you are adding content to it. But it's funny, yeah, the interpretations of what people have for those extra pages.
Again, as I've been watching the responses and thinking about this stuff, I find it fascinating. I genuinely do, and to me, it says something more or as much about human nature and human psychology as it does about pure economics. The idea that I could take this month's issue of New Avengers, which is going to ship and cost $3.99 as they have now for a while, and I can put it out, and there'll be a certain number of people who grumble about it because it's $3.99, and who wants to pay $3.99 for anything? I don't necessarily want to pay $3.99 for anything, but that's what it costs, and that's what it costs. I don't want to pay what I'm paying for gas right now, but I do it because I need my gas. But the people that go and pick up their New Avengers at that price, they read it and they're satisfied. They like the story. They don't like the story. They like the art. They don't like the art. It's a comic book and they read it. If I took that exact same issue, added 16 pages and reprinted, Brian's first issue of Avengers, let's say, same price, I've just added 16 pages of material to it, and it's the same book in every other way, shape, or form, there would be fans that would be screaming bloody murder.
Yeah.
And it has everything to do with their perception, that suddenly the money they're spending on that $3.99, some of it is going to this. I don't want that. I don't want that reprint. I don't want that backup. I don't want that interview. I don't want that whatever. Not quite making the leap of, the month before you didn't get any of it at all. you know, and again, I'm not saying that they're wrong. They feel the way they feel. It's a natural, it's an instinctive response.
Certainly.
I just find it very fascinating the way this works.
Well,
that actually, you know, for all that, there's been all this hullabaloo, you know, amongst, you know, various companies of, you know, putting in backups and doing more for the buck and you know, really trying to make these things worthwhile. Beyond a certain point, you know, you're almost spending a lot of effort to make people more unhappy.
Well, but, you know, if anything, though, yeah, I can understand that, and I can understand the frustration for that as well, but it kind of speaks to a bigger issue, or at least a change in the relationship between the audience and the content providers in all media, because I heard even Leo Laporte talking about this, just talking about media in general last night in a panel that he did in a conference, and how, and I'm sure you can appreciate this, too, because going from that exclusive letters to the editor, letter page communication to the world we're in today of blogs and websites, I can even say specifically that an interview at the back of an issue of a Marvel comic, just the way my mind works, it's like, well, you know something? I read and listen to podcasts of more in-depth interviews on a regular basis. So, yeah, it does kind of feel like fluff coming from Marvel itself rather than being something, you know, really penetrating. And then again, you know, hey, I can even point to good examples of filler, like when Alan Heinberg included his scripts for those first issues of Young Avengers and how the script changed and everything, and that was something of value. But you're right. I think it's that it's valuable to have this kind of level of communication now from the market telling you what works and what doesn't work. And I know you're a believer of that as well, or else you wouldn't have your blog, and you wouldn't be interacting with your readers that way.
Yeah, well, it's... You know, the other aspect of this too is that every reader is mostly concerned about themselves.
Absolutely.
You know, and you know, I look at something like, you know, we've put this interview in the back of a particular book or what have you, and that's really no different in its way than running, you know, Stan running a Bullpen Bulletins page.
You're right.
You know, it's just that the world has changed a little bit, and people have so much more access to so much more of this that maybe it doesn't feel quite as special. It's weird. You know, I could run 8 pages of ads for other Marvel books, and you know, the most people would say is, "Boy, they sure run a lot of ads this month. Maybe they couldn't get a lot of advertising from real people." Ha ha ha! But they wouldn't feel cheated by it. But if I run an interview that at least theoretically has got some content value, and maybe some content value to somebody who hasn't, you know, gone to this particular website or hasn't, you know, seen the million things. You know, that too, though, is just seen as you're trying to steal my nickel. I could have paid a nickel less for that issue of Avengers, and you know, give me the ads instead, which is not really what they're saying, but that's almost how it translates at a certain point. I'm doing more work so that you can be more unhappy with it, and I'm not, you know, I'm not really griping about it. I find it fascinating, and you know, somewhere within it, I think is the key to making this all work. I just haven't cracked it yet.
No, I understand, and we all struggle with that. And also, in fairness,
but you can follow my struggle at Twitter at Tom Brevoort.
And I do. No, but I will say too that I do think a small part of that as well is what came out at the Marvel shareholders meeting when the question of going up to $3.99 was put to a vice president,
right?
Who did kind of say, "We're testing the market." You know, I mean, it's it wasn't as much as of an economic need as it was really a company seeing how much money it can make.
I think, I mean, yeah. This is sort of an area I can only get into so far, clearly. But I think people have ascribed a certain number of motives without, you know, and thought processes without really stopping to think what that meeting was and what that meeting was about. You know, it's a vice president talking to a bunch of shareholders at a shareholders meeting about how much money they're all going to make by buying and investing in Marvel stock.
Sure.
And pretty much, you know, to some degree, your message there is going to skew towards that is your audience. You know, which is not to say that, you know, whatever stuff was said was untruthful, but, you know, it may not have been the entirety of the picture either. And again, I think a lot of people read that stuff and just took, you know, the worst possible interpretation of it and then decided that was what the truth was. We do that a lot in the world of comics.
Well, and I don't think I was going to say I don't think comics are exclusive to that kind of scrutiny.
No, true but, enough.
Yeah, no,
all those evil Twilight fans that are coming out to ruin our conventions.
I know. I know. No, I
do. Do they have the cover charge? Let them in.
Exactly.
Let them in. They can read comics too. It's fine.
Put the stones down. We all live in the same glass house.
They're only scary at a distance.
I completely agree. I know we're at an hour. Am I abusing my time? Because I don't want to mess you up. If you got
we're going. I mean, I have to do something here eventually. My
okay.
email box is now full a screen and a half. But we're going for the moment, so we can do at least a little more.
Okay, a couple quick questions then. You mentioned Spider-Woman. Are you editing Spider-Woman as well?
Once again, my associate editor, Lauren Sankovic, is editing Spider-Woman directly.
How much input do you have on the motion comic side as an editor?
It was interesting because at the outset, I was involved relatively significantly, but again, mostly on the story end, on the script end. You know, that Brian wrote scripts, and you know they came through me as the first sort of line of vetting. But really, Spider-Woman was the first motion comic that we've done, and we were figuring out how to do it.
Understood. Yes.
And it's the first motion comic that we've done that's original material. It's a lot easier to do, say, Astonishing X-Men, because hey, you got six issues of Astonishing X-Men, and they're right there, and go cast your voices and build your soundtrack and build your animatics. This was a little bit different, and we kind of felt our way along. And so I was involved at the story level, like I would be, working on individual issues. And at a certain point, as voice casting began to get underway, and tapes kept coming, and little storyboards started showing up, and so forth. I kind of stepped back from it a little bit because I felt like there were enough cooks in the mix already. Joe Q was looking over everything, and a million other folks who had more attention on this, and all I was going to be was, one more crazy voice making things hard for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I still sort of had access to a lot of that. They would still send me the links and stuff, but I wasn't as involved at that point. That was really more Joe and Ruan, our guy who deals with things like this, and the online guys and so forth.
From a story,
and Brian and Alex, obviously.
From a story beat standpoint, are there things that you would do differently?
I don't know if there's things I would do differently. Certainly there are differences between the motion comic and the print comic.
Yes, and I've been interested to compare both, and
yep.
I've bought both issues and have talked to Brian about the first issue. So.
And that's all going to continue all the way through because there are certain things that you do and that work better on the motion end, and there are certain things that work better on a print end. There are certain things that don't translate. Certainly if you have a long-running chase scene involving flying cars, in motion comic time, that's all motion and that's all the time, and on a printed page, that's all space, and maybe there needs to be a little more dialogue, or maybe there needs to be some sound effects, or maybe there needs to be something to help close some of these gaps.
I see.
Honestly, even between the point at which, the scripts went through my hands to where the motion comic ended up, a bunch of things changed around because there was stuff that read perfectly wonderfully on the page, when Brian wrote it, that once you put it into the mouths of actors having to act and interpret these things, it didn't come across the same way. And so some of that stuff, a lot of that stuff got rewritten by Brian on the fly, and that's all kind of being retrofitted back into the print comic. So I don't know that it's that there are beats that I would have done differently. I just, I didn't know how to do this any more than anybody else.
Sure.
So, I sort of approached my end of it like I'm going to, I'm working on the Spider-Woman comic, and they're going to motion it a little bit. But I would evaluate it based on that.
What do you think about the differences, too? Because, I really do think, and everyone understands, that these are the first steps on these new platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the motion comic, but now what's going on with digital comics, and really not only digital comics, which we've had for a few years, but moving from the desktop to the phone. And I wonder if that also goes through your mind or a creator's mind when they're beating out the story and it's being viewed on a phone as opposed to the way it's laid out on the page. Because I've found it interesting to see the different uses of starting on an extreme close-up of two people talking and then the next panel being the same piece of art but blown up to its full size, and you've got a big panoramic scene with the characters in the forefront. The way that story's been told is changing visually using, you know, the one piece of art.
Well, again, it's definitely going to have an effect and an impact in the same sort of way, you know, the stuff we were talking about 40 minutes ago about Brian writes a bunch of stories this way and other people react to them. You know, we're figuring this all out, just like everybody else. We're seeing what works and what doesn't, and what works better and what works worse. And it's going to take a little bit of trial and error to figure out how to make these new, you know, these new environments, you know, work to their peak capacity. We've got a bunch of ideas for a bunch of different things that we're going to be trying, you know, in you know, projects in different places, you know, for the next couple of months. And hopefully, you know, any number of them will hit and be wildly successful, and we'll go, ah, that's the way you do it.
Sure.
Got it. Figure it out. Yay. let's do more of that. You know, and as we're, you know, as we're moving there, certainly, you know, there will be a reverse back into what, you know, goes on in terms of print and how the print books are paced and laid out and so forth. But exactly what form that's going to take, it's kind of too early to tell. There absolutely will be an effect. There can't help but be.
Sure. Well, it's going to be interesting getting to those solutions, Tom. And as I wrap up, I'll let you know that I'm glad guys like you are at Marvel, because you clearly have that, you know, being there as long as you have, you've got that perception of what's worked in the past, and you also are very open to the new ideas that a lot of these new creators are bringing. It still feels like Marvel, but it is putting a different spin on Marvel characters than maybe we haven't seen before.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that comes across somehow, some way.
Well, I can hear it from the writers that I talk to that report to you, so they I know they enjoy working with you.
They've all been well paid.
There you go. Well, nice going. So continued success, and looking forward to the changes as they come. And I hope we can talk again and talk
Absolutely.
About, you know, when the new status quo is established, we'll check in and see how things are going.
Yeah, just give a shout. I'd be happy to do it again.
Interesting discussion with Tom Brevoort. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. John Sutris reminding you that Word Balloon is all over the Internet. Of course, we're at our own site, wordballoon.com, where you'll find pretty close to 300 interviews with comic creators and other creators of pop culture. You can find our podcasts at newsarama.com. Subscribe to our feed via iTunes or at our website, wordballoon.com. Any questions or comments about the show, make sure you reach us via email, john@wordballoon.com, or come to the Word Balloon message board. I keep teasing upcoming events involving Word Balloon. They're still in the planning stages, but sooner than later, sometime this month, you'll be hearing about some of the new developments of Word Balloon. If anything, it's more Word Balloon goodness. Until next time, thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2009.